Maybe just my imagination. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and you're listening to the TechNet. Technical Net meets every Sunday night, 8 to 12, 8 to midnight, 4 hours. This is TechNet number 1,592 of the series of TechNets that began in September of 1982. Long time ago, 33 or so years. The main purpose of the TechNet is education. Curious amateurs gather here and literally teach each other the art and science of radio. Because from my point of view, the schools do a mediocre or less than mediocre job of teaching that art and science. The methods they use are locked into a 60-year tradition, and they need an awful lot of updating. Can we jump? As you can tell, in between each transmission, try to remember to wait long enough to listen to the four beeps. When you know you're being called, it's very easy to get excited and squeeze the mic immediately. But try to remember to wait for the four beeps. Otherwise, we time out the machine and people get locked out. We have a very loose schedule that we follow, almost follow, in which during the first hour, from 8 to 9, roughly, we take people who sign in, because they do have a question or a comment, and we take those in order. After that, it's followed by John, KC2WGB, who does about three functions. He maintains the mailbag, which means people who don't yet have the right license, the right equipment, so that they can talk to us directly, do so, and he chooses a few of those that have enough general interest. John also monitors Echolink, so that if you're in the hinterlands and have trouble signing in because we're too quick on the switch, John knows about that, brings it to our attention. And he also monitors the chat room, so you can get other messages in edgewise to us during the TechNet itself. Let me drop. After John gives us a few of the key questions from the mailbag, that's followed by Paul, WS2N, a space expert. And those space people are always doing something exciting. The man who was up there, Scott Kelly, for a year, came down. We're going to hear quite a few stories about him. Other launches are happening. And by way of Elon Musk, he's coming up with techniques by which the booster, first and eventually the second booster stage of a rocket, does its function, boosts the payload up into space, and then turns around and comes back home and lands. What an exciting idea. So we'll be hearing more about that. I'll ask him the usual question of what's Voyager doing this year, this week. Voyager is that spacecraft that's out there 12 billion miles, essentially three times the distance to Pluto, traveling away from us at 40,000 miles an hour. It's a QRP 6-watt transmitter at 8 gigahertz, and here we are 38 years downrange, and it's still talking to us. I think it was launched in 1977. That's a piece of hardware. So Paul will be telling us about that. Alrighty, now it's time for the check-in. Let me drop. You need not check in because you're listening. We don't spend the time of making a great big long list of people listening. After 33 years of the TechNet, 1,592 of them, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. And so you're going to give us your call letters, your name. Try to remember giving me your name because I'm very forgetful. Followed by the word yes. We do have a question or a comment. I'm going to take check-ins right now. Call letters and name, please. K2RI to be listening.
And Julio Richwood, a question. Whiskey, whiskey. Name here is Joe, and yes, this is KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name here is Joe, and yes.
KD2 HUC Steve, and yes.
Me to YY. Joe. Yes.
Okay, we've got Rich, Joe number one, Steve, Joe number two. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2. Glad Swan is out here with the space report. Good evening, Dick. Good evening, John.
Okay, I heard Paul. It was a double that time. I heard a K2 something. The K2 something? Please repeat your call letters and name, sir.
KC2SHO, John.
K2SHO, John. confident enough to get started. The first man on the runway is Rich, N2EO. How are those electrons treating you in Massapequa Park these days, Rich? N2EO, K2RAW in the deck net.
Okay, Dick, good evening, everybody. N2EO. Dick, I have a question that's maybe kind of straightforward. You know, I'm getting ready to fire up that NV2K amplifier. I have to get a set of tubes, brand new tubes, the 3-500s, the triodes, directly heated cathodes. My question is this. You remember I had that 20-amp 220 line put in? Well, Barry K. Bio with a digital multimeter a week ago, we measured it. It's 245 volts right on the head coming out of that outlet. My question is this. There were no extra taps on the transformer. It's 110 or 220. Do you think I have to reduce that voltage with a buck boost transformer? I think you know what a buck boost is, and if not, you can. I'll tell you, and you may want to explain it to others. I have to go, obviously, down 25 volts. Gantic and Tokyo.
Yeah, I see no reason, Rich, that you have to go down 25 volts. You're making it in such a way that you think that raw AC 60 cycle supply voltage is a very critical number. I think it is not a critical number. Almost everyone agrees these days that the so-called 110 volt line is what we used to call it. Almost every main line coming into the house, the phase A and phase B, your red wire to ground and your black wire to ground, almost everybody is running 120, 121 volts these days. And what's really happening at your utility transformer, your pole pig transformer, it really is a secondary winding with a center tap, and nowadays everybody is making it 120, 121 volts each side of center tap. Therefore, normal voltage these days is 242 volts, 121 twice. So on top of that, the 3-500 is a very forgiving tube. I think you can get moderately good operation out of it by feeding it anything as low as 2,400 volts up to 3,800 volts, so to speak. The exact voltage you put on that tube is not very critical. The exact voltage that goes to the filament, if you want maximum life, that's slightly critical. And if Barry makes a measurement of what filament voltage is being supplied, let me drop. What filament voltage is being supplied, what versus what voltage is recommended by the tube manufacturer, if you find that 5 or 10% high for whatever reason, and in theory you should make that measurement when it's under load, because it's under load that really counts, if you know what I mean, not just filament standby voltage, although maybe even that's something critical. So that voltage, life of the tube versus filament voltage, is a fairly critical factor, but plate voltage, not at all, as I see it. As long as you've got a good set of capacitors on that voltage doubler circuit fed by that power transformer inside that Henry 2K, I see no problem with 245 volts going in there. Maybe there are other people on the net tonight that's got other information along these lines. If so, give us your call. It is right now. N2EO to pick it up with some delay, in case anyone else wants to add their information on the subject. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Hey, 2J.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate what you're talking about in terms of filament voltage. In the broadcast world, we find filament voltage really critical because we're looking for the most life that we can get out of the tube. And when I start a new tube, I will generally use the manufacturer's recommended volts. In the case of the, a 3GX3000, it's 7 volts. Actually, 7.5 volts. And as you get into 200 and 300 hours of operation of the tube, you will find that as you slowly back off and you bring it down to, you watch your emission, you bring it down to maybe 7 and a quarter, not quite 7, both, but in that neighborhood is where you will attain maximum life of the continuous duty too. Remember, I'm talking continuous duty in most cases, Class C, so once it's on, it's on. And as the tube ages, you readjust slightly, and you'll find that your most efficient output actually will be in that range, which is a little bit lower than what you started out with. It also depends upon the tube, whether it's a direct filament heat, or there's a cathode involved, whether it's grounded grid, or whether you've got a screen grid. It really all kind of depends, but if you go to Varian or IMAT, they have a number of really good white papers in terms of how to maintain your tube and how to deal with the filament voltage, which is far more critical than plate and screen voltage. It's YWK 2J.
KD2 HUC with a comment.
Steve recognized. Got to go to Steve in a minute. Eric, one other thing that I've read from time to time, very rarely, they discuss the fact that as you change the filament voltage on the exotic kind of tubes that you use, which have an indirect heated cathode, and that cathode has some rather exotic chemistry, where certain chemicals inside of that cathode are supposed to bubble up to the surface at a particular controlled rate. And so the individual chemicals bubble up to the surface at a slightly different controlled rate if you run the filament voltage too high or too low. Are you at all concerned with creating some form of surface contamination of the cathode on running it on low voltage? You're probably not pushing the lowness of the voltage anywhere near that that criticality point that I'm just discussing, but I wonder if you've heard some words along these lines. Eric, KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, if you want to kill a tube really fast, run high filament voltage. Run it higher than what the manufacturer recommends, and you watch a lot of that exotic chemistry boil right off. When you wind up getting space charges and gases, emissions, and all sorts of funny stuff. You run it too low, you do the same thing. That's why you have to really carefully monitor, unless of course it's grounded grid, monitor your grid current and screen current if that's involved. And you will find that as the tube ages, as its ability to emit electrons diminishes, and it happens kind of rapidly in the beginning, it reaches a sort of a plateau, and you find that filament voltage where the currents are exactly right, and if you go a little bit lower, you'll see the output drop. You go a little bit higher, the output's going to drop, and you get right at that right point, and as long as you're not drawing too much cathode current, you're golden. And as the tube ages and you watch it, it will drop very, very, very slowly. I mean, we're talking years of continuous duty, so... you want to kill a tube real fast, make it too hot. K2RIW, K2J.
I thank you for that, Eric. Steve, KD2HUC. Wonder if you've used tubes like 3-500s and Henry 2Ks. And give us a few words on your experience. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick. I don't have much experience with the tubes, but Rich kept throwing around the word buck boost transformer. I do have some experience with them. Most of the bucking transformers don't have taps, and therefore Rich may run into problems. You know, it is March, and it is cold. And Rich may run into some issues as soon as it hits July, and the utility companies decide to fold back their voltage 10-15%. And without the ability to adjust for that, you know, his amp may be lacking. For that reason, he might be better off just going with a regular isolation transformer with a couple of full capacity taps. The standard is usually 2.5% up and down. So at least he'd be able to adjust, you know, based upon the time of year. Just my experience. KD2, HUC, back to net.
I have a quick comment.
Go ahead, Eric.
Typically what most manufacturers will do, the filament circuit will be run by an auto transformer, which will compensate within about 5-6%. It's very effective. I don't know about the Henry 2K, but most tube amplifiers that I've ever worked on has a knob for your bonus voltage. So at least any broadcast gear I've ever worked on. Again, I don't know about the 2K, but...
Yeah, I see no need for the buck boost transformer. If at worst done under heavy air conditioner use and brownouts and whatever, and the voltage goes down lower in the summertime, and if Rich is being fed 218 volts instead of 245, and his Henry 2K under normal service putting out 1500 watts of peak envelope power, and he's only get 1100 watts of peak envelope power, that's a fraction of a decibel or one decibel of difference in power output, 1/6 of an S unit. Without somebody making careful measurements on the air, you would never hear the difference. We amateurs have an extremely strong misunderstanding of what amount of power is good and what amount of power is not good. You do something on a VHF frequency where you create 6 dB of extra insertion loss of your feed line, which cuts your power back by a 4-to-1 factor. Yeah, people are definitely going to hear that. That's a full S unit lower on a well-calibrated S meter and receiver. They're going to hear that. But on HF, where Mother Nature can make the state of the ionosphere can make your signal going to that guy you're talking to go up and down by numbers like 50 decibels. And if the band opens versus closes, 90 decibels of difference. And we're talking about 1 dB of difference because your line voltage is high or low. I think we're spitting in the ocean here and we're getting into the fine details. Let me drop another point on this one. And the 3-500 tubes that are in the amplifier right now, which may be a little bit gassy, and therefore the amplifier is only going to put out 1,000 watts instead of 1,500 watts peak envelope power. If you choose to continue for the time being on those tubes, it doesn't do damage to the amplifier, and you putting out 1,000 watts peak envelope instead of 1,500 watts, that's again 1.5 dB of difference. Almost nobody's going to know the difference. So you have the choice of deciding to buy a brand new set of tubes and have the amplifier a shiny new, so to speak, as far as the tubes are concerned. And I'm guaranteeing you don't have to buy the tubes in matched pairs. And a parallel amplifier doesn't matter. So you have the opportunity here of saving yourself some money on not buying a buck boost transformer, and maybe, depending on the state of the tubes that are there, maybe not buying a brand new set of tubes right now. Those choices are yours, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW, the tech man.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Well, I was not worried about a dB or half a dB here or there. I know better. What I was concerned about is longevity of the tube. The grounded grid, of course, like I said, the directly heated cathode. I just don't want to kill the cathodes, you know, the emission on the cathodes and the new tubes. If they run high, if they run low, that was my only concern. Barry said, I got the sample flying over from Barry, and he felt tubes are bad. He bought it on eBay from a guy in Canada, so we really don't know the history of this thing. Also, I'm changing the parasitic chokes, because Barry said to me that when he tuned it up, he heard a thump, 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 it was starting to go into VHF parasitics, and at one point, I'm going to reset. There are small, I think they're like 10 ohm resistors, from the grids to ground. There's four of them on each... On each pin going to ground from the grid. He said those resistors blew. And that's usually because those resistors are there to protect the cathode, the grid. But he changed the resistors, but like I say, it had a strange VHF parasitic. He said it would sit there going thump, 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 thump. That's why I'm starting all fresh. Not only new tubes, but new parasitic choke stick. You know, 3-500 fees are not expensive compared to the tubes Eric is talking about. Or even an 8877. But for me, they're going to be expensive. I don't want to kill them. Got to take back to Nick and to me.
10 ohm resistors from control grid to ground are primary there for two reasons. They are a slight dampening factor as far as VHF oscillation is concerned, parasitic oscillations. And number two, if the tube does arc over, 99% of the arc overs occur between plate and grid. And so with a resistor from grid to ground, that arc, the peak current going into that grid can be drastically decreased during that incident and save the grid. And that, in my opinion, is the primary reason you burn up those 10 ohm resistors. If they're RCO7, if they're carbon type composition resistors, they do have a funny aging characteristic, but I think an arc over is probably the reason. And some of the articles that you can read about by going to the Doctor Is In the March issue 2016 QST magazine, you'll find out by a letter that I submitted. Let me drop it. A very high percentage of arc overs of tubes, which you want to avoid because in general arc overs are destructive. One of the major causations of arcing is because the person who is inexperienced with adjusting a PI network thinks he is being conservative by starting off with light loading. It's actually the opposite of what you got to do. You got to start off with heavy loading. Make the C2 capacitor near minimum, not near maximum capacitance, near minimum. Start off with heavy loading. That makes the voltage swing on the plate smaller. Therefore, you have much less likely to arc over. Almost any tube can be aggravated into arc over if you adjust the loading so extremely light, because you've closed down the plates of the C2 capacitor of the PI network, the loading control. You go to maximum capacitance on that and then hit resonance. You think you're putting 3,000 volts on the plate. That plate voltage swing can go to 7,000 volts under that condition, and you can force an arc over to happen. So that's what I think most likely blew up those 10 ohm resistors. And so, and the parasitic chokes that are in the plate, when in doubt, it's always a good thing to replace those. Good luck with that project, Rich. I think you've been looking forward to that Henry 2K being on the air for some time. Looks like you're coming down to the final stretch on that one. Next person who signed in was Joe, number one, KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. How are those electrons treating you today, Joe? Over to you, K2RIW in the TechNet.
There we go. I was waiting for the four beeps. Yeah, everything's working good today. I had a good day today. I guess this is a question. All this equipment I have here, you know what, Dick? It's not so amateur. This is really, really high-tech equipment. I don't even know why we're called amateurs. I don't even know why we're called amateur radio operators. It should be more like professional. Like a professional word, you know, like pro radio. But I guess maybe because we don't have to pay the FCC monthly fees to use our equipment. And who really owns all these frequencies? Like, you know, the HF frequencies and the 2 meter frequencies and so forth and so forth. But I gotta tell you, man, this is really high tech stuff. So when I tell people I do amateur radio, you know, they look at me and they, like, you know, do a little smile, like what is this guy talking about? All right, back to you guys. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the word ham, nobody knows for sure where it came from. That usually means a neophyte person who is doing plays and movies and so on, an actor. A neophyte or brand new actor sometimes is called a ham. So I guess in the beginning we had brand new radio operators. Other than that, we're not quite sure where it really came from. Ham somehow became amateur. And amateur meaning that you're not being paid. By FCC rules, you're not allowed to be doing anything with the ham radio equipment that gives you direct remuneration. Cash flow, if you know what I mean. You're not allowed to use it to run a taxi service or a distribution service and so on, a delivery service. So from that point of view, we're not professional. And what else do you call it? Non-professional? Amateur is one thing. Yeah, the words are a bit confusing, and I agree with you. You look at some of these pictures of guys' equipment, like even yours. Got some fancy-looking equipment there that you can see by looking at your picture at QRZ.com. There are amateurs you go to John KC2WGB's website, so to speak, by way of QRZ.com, and you're going to see two separate laboratories just filled from floor to ceiling with equipment. I think he's down to his last 100 pieces of test equipment, so to speak. He's a collector. Let me drop him. In his occupation, he ran into a very lucky situation where people were deciding that the equipment they had was no longer required, and they were looking for somebody to acquire it, and John was in the right place at the right time. He fell into a few of those deals, and he knows the values of things, so he's collected a lot of stuff. So you're absolutely right, Joe. We're not amateurs. And so one last question to you, Joe. What word would you use for the service that we provide? If it's not called amateur radio, what would you call it, Joe? You might not have an answer yet, but you're going to think about it. KC2QIW, K2IW, the TechNet.
Yeah, buddy, so true about that. Give me a week. I'll definitely tell you next week. Yeah, so I went on the QRZ over there, and I put up a new picture up there, my new radio up there, the 3000D, J2 3000D. But for some reason, that website, they only show you one picture up there. I wanted to put up a couple more pictures up there. But I'm gonna have to get back to you guys with the new name of, you know, the new amateur radio. Ham radio, whatever. Amateur radio name. So that's about it. And thank you for the help.
Good, Joe. We'll be looking forward to hearing your new set of words next week or the week after. And when you do go to KC2WGB on QRZ.com, not on the first page, but on the place where you can put a whole lot of pictures. He's got a whole lot of pictures on that main page where it first comes up. On the page itself, they only allow one picture. Down below that page, you can put a whole lot of pictures. John did it, so maybe you want to check with John to find out how he did it. If you have difficulty doing that, Steve is next. KD2HUC. Steve, how are they treating you over there in your neck of the woods? HUC, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, that's usual. Onward and upward. This week I have what I hope will be a fast question. I'm putting together a power supply. And my question is, I've done a lot of research and I've seen answers both ways, but I wanted to get the TechNet's opinion. When it comes to linear power supplies, what is, from a RF perspective, is there a better design? And when I say design, I mean a full bridge rectifier as opposed to a center tap transformer with two diodes. I've seen arguments both ways on the internet, and I just wanted to get the TechNet's opinion on that. KD2, HUC, back to you.
From a slightly different point of view, Steve, I went down this road with my strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432. That's the article you can look at in the archives of ARRL, QST Magazine, February and March 1972. And the March issue, the article is broken up into two separate issues. The March issue discusses the power supply. And in those days, I was not using a fancy hypersil transformer these days that you can buy. I was using a transformer of a little bit lower quality, but I went through two or three of these transformers before I discovered that full wave, half wave, doesn't matter. When you are peak rectifying the voltage out of a transformer and shoving it directly into a capacitor as part of the power supply, as the capacitors become large, as the transformer becomes low in resistance because you've got the big fat windings, and as the diodes are really high in quality, you get peak current out of those diodes that only flows for about 5 degrees of the 360-degree cycle. So you may think you're building a half ampere power supply, but the peak current is occurring at, numbers like 10 amperes peaks on a half ampere power supply because you're conducting for such a small angle. The amount of thermal energy lost in the secondary winding, the heating phenomena, is a function of peak current squared, not average current. So the heating of the winding was huge. What I did with the transformers I had access to in those days, let me drop them. As I went into a choke input filter network on the power supply, choke input power supply. There's a couple of disadvantages of that. but you study any of the schematic diagrams of high-powered commercial transmitters and broadcast transmitters. Essentially, all of them use choke input. A choke input power supply can be conducting current on the rectification circuit the full 360 degrees instead of 5 degrees. Makes a huge difference in transformer winding, heating, and a whole lot of other factors. That's the good news.
Step start.
Step start also. That helps some. But I'm not talking about the inverse current. I'm just talking about the continuous running current. It's huge when you've got a capacitor input power supply. So if you were able to arrange a power supply for choke input, you come out with a lot more efficiency, a lot less heating, a lot more life of all of the components. But you've got to obey a couple of other rules. The voltage out of the transformer has to be higher because the inductance of the choke is giving you a certain amount of step back in the rectified filtered voltage that you get. Also, at the instant you turn the turn the power supply off, not turning it on, when you turn it off, if you happen to do it at the instant of time that your local power company is going through 0 volts, you would think everything's hunky-dory. That's the time in which the magnetic winding of the transformer has the maximum stored energy. At the instant you create an open circuit on that primary because you've turned off the switch, you get an inductive kickback, then an inductive kickback through your rectifying diode into a choke input can make you a huge peak inverse voltage that can kill your diodes. So you've got to put a damping network in there in order to protect the diodes from that phenomena when you're using choke input. Let me drop. So as you see, Steve, there's a couple more factors to be considered here. Full wave versus half wave, those are minor differences in details. Use a transformer with low enough resistance to it so it's not getting heating. Use diodes of high enough quality, capacitors of high enough quality, and maybe a series resistor. And this is something I haven't seen, but I'm thinking about it. A small series resistor of a couple of ohms into those filter capacitors, that along with a step back starting circuit, could make things more friendly. So my main point, I guess, Steve, is that there's a little bit more to kilowatt vicinity power supplies than just full wave versus half wave and center tap and whatever. In my opinion, those are fairly minor details. Drag your feet a little bit, Joe, in case other people have opinions on this. KD2HUC with a little bit of delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Just see the size of my inrush resistor.
Yeah, tell me the size of your inrush resistors. They're probably in the order of a quarter of an ohm or something like that. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, it depends on the transmitter. Some of them are like a quarter of an ohm, half an ohm, but they're like 200 watts or 400 watt resistors. They're big bullets, brothers.
Are those resistors there continuously or only during startup?
Depends on the manufacturer. If you're doing a cheapy little thing that's maybe a 3 kilowatt, they tend to be in line all the time. If you're doing something like the 60 kilowatt, they pop in and out according to what stage it is step start. And we're talking multiple step starts to the IoT, so, you know, big cuts.
And those inrush resistors, quarter ohm, half an ohm, maybe in the ham circuit, it's going to be 1 ohm, in series with your filter capacitor. That can take that 5 degree conduction angle on rectification, 60 cycle, 5 degrees of rectification current, and make it 10 degrees real fast. That, in some cases, can take the secondary winding of the power transformer, the heating, can change by a 4-to-1 ratio because of that simple resistor. And the amount of regulation you lose because of that resistor is a very minor factor. Another thing people worry about a little bit with power supplies for a linear amplifier is you'd like there to be enough energy storage of the filter capacitors so that during the usual peak envelope power of your human voice, the voltage doesn't drop a whole lot. That can give you a certain kind of distortion so that if the human voice goes down to, let me pick a number, 300 hertz, let me drop it.
You know, I could be wrong, but I think he was talking about a linear supply as opposed to a switching supply.
2QIQ with a comment?
I'm talking about a linear supply. I'm not talking about a switching supply. And so, you'd like those rectifiers, filter capacitors, to have enough energy storage so that at the lowest frequency, sideband linear amplifier. That's where it's drawing current. It liked the power supply not to droop a whole lot during the cycle. Let's see what Mr. QIQ has got to say on this one.
Go with Glenn.
Okay.
Analyst, dig into me.
Yeah, I'm terrible on names, so go right ahead, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Just a couple of comments. The first question that he asked was, what was the difference between a power supply with using the full bridge rectifier or using the center tap with two diodes, full bridge rectifier? In other words, there's basically a four-diode version or the center tap with two diodes. The real difference there is voltage in the output. If you look at the voltage drop on a single diode and you have basically a four-diode bridge, if each rectifier is 0.7 volt drop, in any conduction cycle, you're going to lose approximately 1.4 volts per swing. So in voltages of the power supply that are 12 volts and greater, it's not much of a concern. But if you're going to build a power supply that's only going to have a 5-volt output, a 2.5 volts, or a 1-volt output, you can see how much the rectifier drop is going to contribute to the output voltage of the power supply. So on low-voltage power supplies, 5 volts and below, certainly the center tap with the two diodes is the better choice than using the one with the four diodes. Let me let it drop.
Yeah, he might be talking about the 3,000-volt power supply for the linear amplifier. He might not be talking about a DC filament supply. Over to you for more on this one, Glenn. Go ahead.
Here again. The purpose, the only real purpose for the two diode with the center tap is low voltage. Higher voltages, the bridge would certainly be the better choice. And here again, if it's high enough voltage, you may have to stack your diodes. So in other words, you'd have to stack your diodes and probably put capacitors across the diodes to build up the string. So there again, it's really voltage drop dependent, depending on the amount of output voltage. The other comment was in the linear power supply and output storage capacitance. The output storage capacitance really should always be determined for the amount of ripple from no load to full load and find out how much ripple can you tolerate. In the case of a regulator, in other words, if you're using a regulated output on your filtered input capacitance, then you have a regulator, then you don't have to worry so much about the size of the capacitor to hold the load, because now you can actually drop some of that load voltage across the regulator. It's a little more costly in terms of efficiency, but certainly you don't need as much capacitance and your power supply can be smaller. Back over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I need a comment. I use the bridge to make split supplies, especially for audio.
Yeah, give us a few words on that, Eric.
Yeah, you know, when you're doing stuff with op-amps and stuff like that, you'll need a plug and linear supply. You wind up do this using one nice transformer, and a bridge is kind of the way to go. It makes it clean. And you can do it with two diodes and a center tap to support the center tap transformer, but the bridge is just so much easier.
Big GPZ, can I make a comment even though I'm a pirate?
So as I see it, Steve, if you are going out to buy a transformer that has enough winding, enough voltage in the secondary winding, yes, you have the ability to choose a winding with enough voltage, so you have the ability to use the grounded center tap and then two diodes from the two ends. If the particular transformer you have in your hand will only give you the right amount of high voltage by using the whole Don winding with a bridge rectifier with four diodes, then you really have no choice. So I wonder where you are, Steve. Are you choosing a transformer with twice the voltage because you want to use a center tap? And even if you make that choice, you're now using two diodes versus four diodes, and we're talking about 1.5 volts of drop, or half a volt of drop, so to speak. When you're building a 3,000-volt power supply, that sounds like we're spitting in the ocean here. KD2HUC, we may have misunderstood your question a bit, Steve. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Can we go with a comment on this thing?
Can you make a comment even on my pilot?
Steve, go right ahead with your information.
All right, Dick, let me, first off, are you hearing me okay? I had to switch repeaters because I was getting a lot of static out of Glen Oaks. Are you hearing me all right?
You sound beautiful. Please proceed.
Okay, let me clarify. First off, this is going to be a 13.2 output power supply. In the order, the transformer right now is a blank slate. It's nothing more than a bunch of E's and I's. So I can make it whatever I want it to be. The core is rated for 2 kVA. Obviously, you know, I was aware of the voltage drop, you know, as far as a bridge versus the center tap configuration. You know, when it comes to 100 to 150 amp output, you know, one and a half volt drop can be significant as far as IR loss. But let me let it drop.
You did make it clear that you're talking about a 13 volt power supply, and what on the linear amplifier needs 13 volts? Is that some kind of a bias voltage? Over to you, Steve.
That's why I said linear switcher. You were talking about a linear supply, not switcher.
Yeah, Eric's got it right, Dick. When I said a linear supply, I meant that I wasn't using a switching. I was using a linear-based power supply. And basically, it's to power a bunch of different things that operate at 13.2 volts. I was, you know, I got my hands on a transformer core that I'm right now disassembling into the E's and I's. And as I'm designing the winding, I wanted to know which way would be better. You know, using the center tap versus the full bridge. You know, I didn't know if there was anything from, you know, an RF perspective where you're better off with one design over another. And that was kind of where I was going with the question. KD2HUC.
You've got to regulate it.
Eric asked that question, Steve. Steve, are you going to be using a regulator, or is this going to be raw 13.2, which some people call 13.8, by the way? Many of our pieces of electronics are very happy on something like 13.8. Over to you, Steve.
Yeah, 13.2, 13.8. The power supply per se is not going to be regulated. Most of the equipment that I'm running on it has front end regulation on them. So basically, I'm just looking to put out a very raw, you know, significant power source for those devices. And the transformer, I wound for 220 volts, and I may include a couple additional windings in the primary to handle a soft start function. I haven't really efforted that far out yet until I have the secondary design down. 82HUC.
Steve, if you're designing this power supply, there's a little something else that's worrying me. With almost all reasonable designs of a power supply that has no regulator, if I set my voltage to be under full load of all the equipment running full blast, all the load on the 13.2 volts, so to speak, I'm running real 13.2 volts output. And now I turn off many of those loads, maybe all of them, with absolutely no regulation, that darn power supply, even a high quality one, can easily go up to, let me pick a number, 15, 16 volts under no load. So having absolutely no regulator on the voltage that goes to all of your equipment, even though they have an individual regulator on them, and not all of our rigs have regulators in there. Yeah, they got regulators in there for certain key functions, like the voltage that goes to the voltage-controlled oscillator, the VCO, of the phase lock loop. But the main input usually does not have a regulator. So if you're designing a power supply without a regulator, I'm not so convinced that that's recommended. I wonder what made you decide on that simplification choice. Over to you, Steve, K2LAW.
Well, the majority of the equipment is designed to run in the car. And, you know, if you've ever put a DVM on a car, I know in my cars the voltage tends to fluctuate, you know, from all the way from 12 volts if the engine's not running, all the way up to 14 and a half if it's racing, even though it is supposed to be regulated. So I'm assuming the regulators in the front end of the devices are designed to handle that.
Okay. If we did a survey of all the people that are on this frequency right now, of the power supplies they're using to run their rigs, it is my guess that 95% of those people are using a power supply that has a built-in regulator. Just pure rectification and capacitor filtering. As a power supply for our kind of equipment, I think very few people build that kind of a supply. I think almost every so-called 13-volt, so-called 12-volt power supply that you and I buy, every commercial product of any quality, has a built-in regulator. Am I wrong on that? everybody is running a regulated supply. So I think you're going down a slightly dangerous path here. That's my opinion, Steve. Erica, give us some words on this.
Yeah, you don't realize it, but typically on most VHF, UHF, the hammered, the commercial rig, the power supply, the input to the power supply, is right to the albatrosses. There's no regulation involved. It's tough enough to make the albatrosses just operate on 12.6 ohms. One thing about a car is you've got the battery in there all the time, so it has a little bit of a buffer. You know, level of overvoltage. I've never seen a car go over 15 volts. But, you know, when you're talking about the power transformer, hook up to the line voltage, and the transients are switching things on and off because it's just an inductive system, can be rather dangerous. If you look at the typical battery charges, you'll find out that they got halfway rectifiers and very little filtering. Unless you start adding capacitors to make it clean. By the way, the difference between a bridge and a full-wave rectifier in terms of the output and the difficulty in filtering is the difference between the two of them. Bridge gives you a little bit less of a hard job to deal with. Depending on your application, how much current you're going to draw. And of course, depending upon the load that you put on an unregulated supply and how big the gaps are, you can run into all sorts of really bad issues. So. But most ham power supplies, whether it's an Astron or something made by the manufacturer, they're regulated.
With a comment.
I think almost all of us are running a regulated supply, Steve. And Eric just brought up another good point. Yeah, you can get some pretty wicked transients of current on an automobile, but that current is going into a battery, and that battery is the equivalent of a 1 farad capacitor. And maybe it's a 50 farad capacitor. It can take a lot of those spikes away. Whereas your unregulated power supply, being fed by Con Ed, Loco, PSE&G, occasionally you're going to get some spikes in overvoltage out of that supply for brief periods of time. But a spike out of your Con Ed power, so to speak, your Loco power, could easily bring your rectifiers with no regulator up to 25 volts of output. And even though it's a brief period, you apply 25 volts to any of your rigs, I think you're pushing your luck. So my strongest recommendation, since almost nobody is using anything that we buy, even the cheapest power supplies we buy intended for our so-called 12-volt rigs, essentially every single one of them has a regulator, and you've decided I can name that tune with one note, I don't need a regulator. I think that's a dangerous choice, Steve. I may be overly conservative here, but that's my warning. KD2HUC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
N2EO, Dick.
All right, Dick, so then how would I scoured the net. I didn't see much in the way of 200 amp, you know, devices for regulation. All the documents I read said that design the regulation into the transformer and you know, make it as tight as you can for the range that you have, you know, as far as current draw. So I mean, does anybody know of any decent devices for to regulate, you know, 150 to 200 amps DC? A
couple of simple solutions to that.
Steve, you are keeping all kinds of secrets from us. Why in the world do you need a 200 amp power supply to power ham radio equipment? Over to you on that one, Steve.
I didn't say it was just for ham radio equipment, did I, Dick? I have a bunch of stuff. You know, one of the devices that I was looking at as far as a linear four. VHF and UHF service required 45 amp input, plus the 25 amps for the radio. Plus, I have a bunch of other stuff, weather station equipment and whatnot that draws current. I was kind of making one power supply for everything. Is that a bad idea? KD2HUC.
No point of failure.
Now I agree with you, Eric. He seems to want 150 and 200 amperes of quasi-regulated voltage. What would you consider doing that, Steve? I mean, Eric, I think there are some these regulators, and they're tolerant to being powered like that. I bet you know some of those, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW in the deck net.
Yeah, well, K2LAW, K2EJ. One of the simplest solutions is a company called SOLA, S-O-L-A, that makes auto transformers. There's very good regulations. That's one simple solution. That and, you know, big set of Husky diodes. You can get 200 amp diodes. It's easy. Make sure you hit the thing right. But if you want to make a regulator, use some really cheap transistors. Let's see. The 400 amp regulator I made was built out of 22 2N 3055. Actually, that works. Not really efficient. But if you don't mind spending like 120 or 130 bucks, you can buy a 200 amp switching supply at 12 volts. Not bad. Actually, a lot of, in the old days, in the 80s and 70s, a lot of it gave because we didn't have the kind of LSIs that we've got today. You know, the one device that I used to work on needed a 500 amp supply at 5 volts. So. Well, it was just that box that hung on the back of the door, but things like that are available. But there's a lot of little tricks you can do. Let me try to drop for a second. We have IBGT devices that are capable of doing 200 amps and 400 amps. Again, you need a little mechanical structure and heat sinking to make them happen. You'd be surprised, we've got Triacs that actually operate at a 500 amp. So, you know, today, getting semiconductors to do that kind of power is not all that difficult.
Yeah, we got a couple of pieces of good news here for you, Steve, now that we understand the problem a little bit more. First of all, what Eric is telling you about is there's a kind of a resonant regulating transformer, that solar transformer, where the input voltage can be from 90 volts to 140 volts, and it still gives you a constant 120 volts output if you bought the one-to-one version of it. So that kind of a transformer does give you regulation. The other approach is that when you're into that kind of current, anything more than 150 amperes, I don't think you want a linear supply. I think you want a switching supply. There's a whole bunch of reasons for that. Now, a very crafty solution. One of my ham radio buddies did 10 years ago. On the surplus market, somebody was selling 150 ampere switching power supplies, but they only put out 5 volts. But it was a completely floating output, because of the toroid transformer that was in there on the switching supply. He bought 3 of them for something like 30 bucks a piece. 150 amperes at 5 volts. He put the 3 supplies in series because the output was thoroughly floating. Yes, that would give him 15 volts, but they had a voltage control on them. He cut each one of them back down to 4 and a fraction volts so that the total output of the 3 switching regulators at 150 amps of output, now gave him 13.8 volts. And he used that for a number of years. Saved himself a boodle of money on the surplus market by buying something out of the ordinary. Nowadays, nobody needs 150 amperes at 5 volts anymore. Therefore, those kind of power supplies are sometimes very cheap. So rather than building this stuff when you can possibly buy it at a small fraction of the number of man hours it's going to take you to do it, you might want to consider that one, Steve. KD2HUC, if you need some more words on this. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2, do I queue with a few more comments, Dick?
Yeah, let me hear from Steve first. Go ahead, Steve.
Actually, Dick, I really wanted to build this one because one of the stepping stones that this was going to lead to is building a custom transformer to supply the final transistors of a linear amp that I talked about probably about a month or so ago. There really was nothing decent on the market for a reasonable price, so I decided I was going to wind it myself. And so just to vet out any design errors, I was going to start with something simple like this. So that's why I was going to build it. I know that 13-volt power supplies are a dime a dozen, and you can parallel a bunch of them up. But I was wondering, does Eric have any, that power supply he designed, are those schematics floating around out there anywhere? KD2HUC.
Yeah, we're going to go to Eric right after Glenn. Glenn, I know you want to put some words into this. I wonder, Glenn, have you worked on 150 or 200 ampere switching power supplies in the 13.5 volt output region. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I might have designed one or two, Dick. But, I just a couple of pointers I wanted to point out here. One is the winding of that transformer and the coupling at 200 amps is going to be a very, very difficult thing to achieve. Another couple of things to keep in mind here is 12 volts at 100 amps is basically 1200 watts. And that's kind of the limitation of what you're going to do on a 120-volt outlet. So, in other words, right now, I hope your transformer is going to be, your design is starting at 240 volts, because a 240-volt winding, at least you can get, you know, 20-amp capability. You're going to be at least in the correct power range. So, start with a 240 design on the input. Definitely don't go with 120 if you want to get 12 volts at 200. I think you may want to start looking into some possible switching designs in this area, and also think about regulation. I think when you start finding out what's really involved with putting the correct insulation in the transformer so that the transformer doesn't either catch on fire or burn or create an electrical shock hazard from the 240 shorting out onto the secondary side, there's quite a few things you might have to look into in that transformer design. Here again, I'm really not familiar with how much transformer design you've done in the past, but here again, maybe you might want to give us a few words on that to give us a little bit better feeling. But I'm going to pass this back to Dick first. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
As all of us are discovering here, Steve is getting into some fairly high energy physics here, and Glenn is giving us a hint about that. Now, I'm afraid, Eric, that when it comes to a 150 or 200 ampere regulator, where in one case you parallel 2N3055 transistors, very popular, inexpensive TO3 package, I think it is, and you put 22 of them in parallel, my guess is there was no well-published schematic diagram in how you did that. I think you were creating it. But maybe you know of a popular schematic diagram that's got some track record for a 150 or 200 ampere voltage regulator. KE2EJ, for any words on that? K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, actually, it was kind of inspired by a device that was made called a phase linear. We used to call it a flame linear. Flame linear. It had 48 2N3055s in the output, and it was a 1500 watt per channel audio amplifier. Basically, it's just, you know, a pair of transistors to set the output and build it like a totem. And you just put them all in parallel and, you know, make sure you got big enough in the middle resistance so they don't fry. But he's talking about his future project, which is based around a phase-scale chip. That needs a 50-volt supply. I mean, that gets really easy. That's a whole other animal. It's been trying to produce just 12 volts at the kind of current. Transformers get big. I mean, if you really want to cheat, you can go to Sears and get one of their large 300-amp battery chargers, continuous 300-amp. The size of the transformer and that mother, and use that as your output and clean that. It's actually somewhat self-regulated, but it's filthy. It's only halfway rectified, which is disgusting. But it looks good for charging daddy. I suppose if you do a Google search for linear supplies that operate at 200 amp, money at a drop. I haven't actually tried, but I'm sure there might be something out there. But if you're going to go, that route, you know, really want to set up a system like that, I'd go buy something that's made already. You can learn as much as you need about power supplies by making a 1-amp power supply. By the way, when you go to make your 50-volt supply, there's a lot of tricks. You don't even have to use a transformer if you want to get really funky about it. But, a simple 2-to-1 transformer will take care of your problem there. And you don't really have to worry about regulating it because it's going to be operating class C, and who cares? K2RIWK, DJ.
So as we're hearing, Steve, the very high power output RF linear amplifier transistors you can buy these days